Lecture 8, The Seleucid Realm.
Hello and welcome back to our series of lectures on the Hellenistic Age. We've now had an opportunity to look in depth at one of the most famous of the Hellenistic kingdoms, namely the Egypt acquired by Ptolemy after the death of Alexander and ruled by his descendants for the next 300 years. And we saw that at Alexandria, we were able to find evidence for a Greek city that showed little attempt to fuse the cultures of the Greeks and the Egyptians. Although in the case of the library and the museum, I've suggested that it may be possible that an Egyptian template or model provided the outline for that particular institution. But most of the culture and the scientific research that we found going on at the library and in the museum, we saw as continuations of earlier Greek culture, exclusive, not designed to fuse the two races at all. The second Hellenistic kingdom that we should include in our survey is one which is a little less known to people. It made not such an impact in the way that the Ptolemaic kingdom did. And yet it is an area that embraced a far greater amount of sheer territory than did Ptolemaic Egypt. And in some respects, the Seleucid realm, with its heartland of Syria, but its outlying provinces as well, was in a way the nearest thing to a continuation of Alexander's empire. At its greatest extent, the Seleucid realm, named after its founder, Seleucus, another one of Alexander's officers, at its greatest extent, this realm included all the territory of Asia Minor, all of Syria, much of the area of Arabia, of Mesopotamia, and way across through modern-day Iraq and Iran, all the way to the eastern end of Alexander's empire. So in sheer geographic scope, we're looking at something that resembles what Alexander's empire would have been had he continued alive for another 30 or 40 years. And what we're going to find when we examine this empire, that of the Seleucids, is that once again we don't see a fusion of cultures, as early historians have argued, but here we're going to have even better evidence for the imposition of Greek culture over native populations, except at the very eastern edges. And there we're going to find a hybrid culture in the region of Bactria, an area where Greco-Bactrian kingdoms will eventually emerge. And we're going to look at that in another lecture because it's very interesting material. But let's first begin with an outline of how the empire of the Seleucids takes shape. Well, Seleucus was assigned the satrapy of Babylon upon Alexander's death, and this was a potentially very rich power base. He, however, was left to assert control of the territory by himself. None of the other Hellenistic generals, none of the other officers of Alexander's army went to his assistance. And when Antigonus marched east in 316, Antigonus, you'll remember, being one of the few men who had a real shot at uniting Alexander's empire in the next generation, Seleucus temporarily had to flee. And from this very unpromising start, Seleucus then rebounded and went on to exert control over a vaster domain and a larger territory than any other of Alexander's successors. So considerable, in fact, was his success in reclaiming the upper satrapies, as they're called. These are the satrapies of modern-day Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, the region that we used to call the Central Asian Soviet Republics. This area to the far east of Alexander's march. So successful was he in reclaiming control in here that many historians have argued that the Seleucid Empire reached its high point during the reign of its founder, Seleucus I. And the prevailing view that you'll read in textbooks about the Seleucid Empire is that the next 300 years presents a gradual falling away, a decline of power, as the entire empire begins to sink into decrepitude. I don't want to emphasize decline here. That reminds me too much of the whole notion of the Hellenistic period as a period of decadence after the glory of the classical age. And instead, what I'd like to do is to ask, how did Seleucus and his descendants manage to rule and to control so vast a territory? Their territory is really the exact opposite of Ptolemaic Egypt. Ptolemaic Egypt, as we saw, was an ethnic, historic, geographic unity. The Seleucid Empire is the exact reverse. It is geographically vast, it is ethnically varied, and everything about it is dispersed in a way that it isn't in Egypt. Well, the answer is that, in fact, intelligently, Seleucus and his descendants adopted a range of different strategies. They did not attempt to impose a single style of rule across the entire empire. And, in fact, their strategies of rule are really dictated by the different regions in which they found themselves as the new ruling power. First of all, we can begin at the far eastern end of his empire, right over towards the Hindu Kush, the area, you remember, where Alexander had stopped only because his army had said no more and had gone into revolt. And in this area, Alexander had established alliances with such kings as Porus and Taxiles, and Seleucus found that the easiest way to maintain his hold on any territory at the far eastern end was to give up the border zone. By 306 BC, Seleucus had established an eastern border, and he had done this by ceding the territory of the Indus Valley and the adjoining desert regions to the Mauryan king Chandragupta, Sandrakotus as the Greeks called him. So establishing a fixed border between the Mauryan Empire of northwestern India and the Seleucid domain, he was able now to concentrate on the west and no longer had to worry about those far eastern domains. In return for renouncing his claims to these territories, really only nominal claims, the Greeks had never controlled this area well, but in return for renouncing his claims and establishing this border, Seleucus was given 500 war elephants. And war elephants are the panzer tanks of Hellenistic warfare, so that it was actually a pretty good deal. By giving up a nominal claim to a region he never really controlled, he was able to beef up his heavy armor quite considerably. And most of the battles of the Hellenistic period are between Greek mercenary armies employed by one Hellenistic king against Greek mercenary armies employed by another, with the heavy impact as their two lines join being given by the elephants. So 500 war elephants was a considerable advantage. In the upper satrapies of Central Asia, a little further west of that eastern border, a region far away though from the Mediterranean, the region where Alexander had tried to conquer the mountain of Aornus and where he had found his wife Roxanne, in these so-called upper satrapies of Bactria and Sogdiana, Seleucus and his son founded dozens of cities with Macedonian veterans and Greek settlers. And this was the hallmark of Hellenization, that you found a city by establishing a garrison, by encouraging trade, you give much of the land to Greek veterans and Greek settlers so that you pour a Greek population into that region. And there the local people continue to serve as the peasants operating at the behest of their Greek overlords. These foundations by Seleucus and his sons swelled to become thriving emporia, cities that dominated the trade routes running across Central Asia, the so-called Silk Route, for example. And we have dozens, literally dozens of cities founded at this time. Antioch Persis, Antioch Margiana, which eventually will mutate into the name Merv, Sotira, Ikarnum, excavated by the French up in Afghanistan, and the island city of Falaika, located just off the coast of Kuwait. These were all either Seleucid foundations or settlements which may have existed before the Seleucids, but which were now made much larger and which thrived as a result of the trade going on under the Seleucids. A good example of this process is to be seen at Antioch Margiana, the city of Merv. It's located in an oasis of fertile territory surrounded by mountains and high desert. So any peoples crossing these deserts and taking their goods, their silks, their spices from the east to the west are going to gravitate to this area going through the oasis. And there had been already an Achaemenid citadel here, a small Achaemenid garrison to watch over the trade running through. The area was captured by Alexander, but what archaeology has shown is that the rapid expansion of Margiana dates to the time of Seleucus. The pottery here dates from his time, as does the pottery from Ikarnum and Samarkand, Now, some of these cities are named for Alexander. Samarkand recalls Alexander's name, but they're actually either foundations of the Seleucids or they really grow to prominence under the Seleucids. Here at Margiana, with the erection of outer and inner walls, we have protected a much larger area. The garrison is transformed into an acropolis located right in the center of town, and then a much larger settlement is laid out in the area below this acropolis, a settlement capable of supporting a large population, an area where caravans can be brought in as well, protecting therefore the caravans that bring silk and spices and other precious commodities into the Seleucid realm. And the land is also being worked as well. A series of canals have been excavated there, showing that the Seleucids paid a great deal of attention to exploiting the land so that they could feed that local population. This was essentially a Greek occupation. It is Greek settlers, Greek soldiers and Greek veterans who populate this site, and there is little sign of any intermarriage between these Greeks and Macedonians or the local population. There's very little sign of any kind of ethnic mixing. So we've seen in two regions so far two quite separate policies. In the east, cede the territory and establish the border. In the northeast, establish cities, trade posts at strategic points, garrison them with veterans, give land to the veterans so that you encourage a Greek population to move east. And in fact, surveys back in mainland Greece have demonstrated that at this time, the population was declining. And the reason for that is not that the Greeks are dying off or that there's starvation. It's because a lot of Greeks are engaging in this Greek diaspora, this movement away from the mainland, out to the land of new opportunity, the provinces of these Hellenistic kingdoms. Why be a poor Greek farming 5 acres of rocky soil when you could be a princeling with an estate of 500 acres in Afghanistan? It was a bargain that many people took. A second region that we should look at that also involved heavy colonization was Syria, the far eastern corner, the northeastern corner at the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. From the Mediterranean across the Fertile Crescent, so this one fertile stretch linking the Mediterranean with the beginning of Central Asia, there stretched a network of Seleucid cities, Laodicea by the sea, Apamea on the Orontes River, Seleuca Pieria and Antioch on the Orontes, and Seleucia on the Tigris. So five major cities, five capitals really, clustered in this area of Syria, which becomes the absolute heartland of the Seleucid kings. It's very interesting if you look at a map and see the layout of this empire and see where the Seleucids choose to stay, they are not interested in moving inland at all. They're not interested in moving to the geographic center of their empire. They don't spend most of their time in Babylon or at Susa. They're not like the Achaemenids, who live essentially in the middle of their empire. Why is this? I think it's because the emphasis in Hellenistic culture, even amongst these Hellenistic kings, is dealing with the rest of the Hellenistic world around the Mediterranean. They're from Macedon and they never wish to lose sight of the Mediterranean. It's by the Mediterranean that you have contact with Egypt, with Asia Minor, and with Macedon and Greece. So there is a heavy concentration then of Greek cities in Syria. And in addition, there were also Greek cities there in Asia Minor, which fell under Seleucid control during the course of the 3rd century. And we're fortunate because here, in the relations between the Seleucids and the Greek cities, we have a good deal of documentation, and it gives us a good idea of how the Seleucids were presenting themselves as kings. And what I think we're going to find here, well, I'll read it first and then see what you make of it. This is King Antiochus writing to the city of Erythrae. Erythrae is a Greek city that had been founded hundreds of years earlier. It was located on what we would call the very western coast of Turkey. That is to say, it was in the region that the Greeks called Ionia, that coastal strip of Turkey, still considered a part of the Greek world because it's on the Aegean coast. And King Antiochus says, to the people and the council of Erythrae, greetings. Thrasinon, Pythes, and Botas, your envoys, handed over the decree to us in which you voted us honours and brought the crown with which you crowned us and likewise the gold offered as a present. So the ambassadors have arrived and they've said, hello king, we've voted you these honours, here is this crown and here's this gold. And they themselves spoke about the goodwill which you have constantly felt towards our house, and in general about the gratitude felt by the people towards all benefactors. So the ambassadors have clearly come with a message of goodwill. They're treating the king not as their supreme overlord. They're not performing obeisance or prostration before him. They're saying, we have voted you honours because you are a benefactor of ours. This is going to be a very potent language in the Hellenistic age, so pay close attention. Now, look at what happens when King Antiochus then responds to these overtures from the ambassadors. He says, since your ambassadors declared that under Alexander and under Antigonus, your city was autonomous and free from tribute, and our ancestors were constantly zealous on its behalf, and since we see that their decision was just, and we ourselves wish not to fall short in our benefactions, we shall preserve your autonomy, and we grant you exemption from tribute. So the nub of the matter was that a Greek city was trying to have its taxes cancelled. But the way in which this is processed or dealt with in the Hellenistic age is that a Greek city will petition its king by offering it honours. They will declare him to be their saviour, their soter. They will call him a benefactor, euergetes. Sometimes they will set up a festival in honour of his dead father and mother, the soteria, a festival in honour of the saviour gods. Or they might even recognise the king himself as a living god, Epiphanes. These are all the terms that turn up in this diplomatic language of the Hellenistic age. And people have wondered about why you get these excruciatingly long documents with this tedious honorific language. And the reason is this is the way that underlings in the Greek world speak to their superiors. They turn the relationship from subjugation into a contract. We'll give you these honours if you'll give us these rights. And what they get in return is something that's of concrete value to them, a tax exemption. That year they didn't have to pay money into the Seleucid treasury. So we see the kings here actually being quite concerned with their prestige and with their relationship with the Greeks. But when it came to other regions, they behaved very differently, because of course in a place like Babylon, there were no Greek cities for them to indulge in this reciprocal relationship. So let's look what happens there. All right, between the Mediterranean and the upper satrapies that we've talked about is the heart of what used to be the Persian Empire. And here the Seleucids could not hope to impress an ancient culture with their Greek manners. They weren't going to convince anybody in Babylon that being Greek was superior any more than the Ptolemies could impose their Hellenistic manners on the priests at Memphis. We've seen how the Ptolemies there behaved as if they were pharaohs. So what did the Seleucids do in Babylon? Well, instead of behaving as Greek kings dealing with their cities, instead they behave as Achaemenid kings, as if they were Persian kings, as if they were the legitimate successors of the kings who had ruled in Babylon. Now, this emerges from a most astonishing letter that we have, and this one is absolutely genuine, which is from King Antiochus, and he is speaking of his position as king of Babylon. Now, this is, remember, a moment ago we heard King Antiochus writing to the people of Erythrae, saying, you know, we're concerned for your justice, our ancestors were concerned for your justice, we wish to be a benefactor as well. Everything was placatory. The Greeks were being mollified. Now listen to the rhetoric that King Antiochus uses in Babylon. I am Antiochus, the great king, the legitimate king, the king of the world, king of Babylon, king of all countries, the caretaker of the temples, Agasila and Azida, the firstborn son of King Seleucus the Macedonian, king of Babylon. So even in his opening rhetoric, he's adopting all of the pomp and all of the grandeur of an Achaemenid king, just like Darius calling himself the King of Kings, the anointed of Ahura Mazda. Not only that, now in what follows, listen to the way he presents himself, what a true king in Babylon would do. When I conceived the idea of reconstructing the temples Esagila and Azida, I formed with my august hands, when I was still in the country, Hatti, the first brick for Esagila and Azida, with the finest oil, and brought it with me for the laying of the foundation of Esagila and Azida. And he goes on, So he actually says, I made the first brick, you know, like a good Babylonian king showing his piety towards these gods, who as a Greek he probably didn't even recognize. He goes on, O Nebo, lofty son, most wise among the gods, splendid and worthy of all praise, firstborn son of Marduk, child of Arua, the queen who fashioned all creation, do look friendly upon me, and may upon your lofty command, which is never revoked, the overthrow of the country of my enemies, the fulfillment of all my wishes against my foes, constant predominance, a kingdom ruled in justice, an orderly government, years of happiness, enough progeny to be your permanent gift to the joint kingship of Antiochus and his sons, King Seleucus. And his son, King Seleucus. This is an extraordinary document. There is nothing Greek in it at all. There is no way in which you would even know that this man was a Greek but for his name. So what we find here is that there is a very sensible policy at work in the Seleucid realm. Here, in an area like Babylon, which in some ways is just like the Nile, where there are great temple estates along the river, we find that there is a policy of recognizing the rights of the temple estates. Okay, as focal points of power and of social organization, the temples remained central to the authority of the region and were therefore protected by the Seleucids. So what we're finding here is that there are different styles of Seleucid kingship, different treatments of different populations depending upon the part of the kingdom that we're talking about. Nevertheless, we need to modify the view that I've been advocating somewhat. It'd be wrong to think that this was simply a world of Greek cities imposed on native populations ruled by a distant and benevolent Hellenistic king. In fact, in the Seleucid realm, a great deal of the very best territory and many of its people would have felt Seleucid rule quite directly. The administration reached into every corner of the kingdom. It borrowed the Persian system of satrapies that had existed even before the Greeks were here. And we know from the documentation that there was a slew of minor officials, in fact, often carrying the same Greek names as the officials in Egypt. The dioiketes, the manager, the logistes, the accountant. So there is an imperial apparatus in the Seleucid realm, just as there is in the Ptolemaic realm. Even more than that, we find in this Seleucid kingdom large swathes of land owned directly by the king. And when I say the land is owned by the king, I mean that every building on it, every village on that land, and the people living in the villages are owned by the king as well. So these people, these peasants, are called the Basiliki Lai, the king's people. They're tied to the land. They pay a tithe, or else a fixed tax every year, and the revenues, the land, the villages, the buildings, and the people could all be bought and sold by the king. This we know from, and this I think truly is one of the most astonishing documents of the Hellenistic age, we know this from a contract between King Antiochus and the woman, Laodike, his queen, who he was divorcing. This is a divorce settlement, and these are some of the terms in the divorce settlement of a Seleucid king. In the month of Dicaeus, King Antiochus writes to Metrophanes, greetings. We have sold to Laodike the village of Panukome, the manor house, the land which is attached to the village. It is bounded by the territory of Zelia and Cyzicus, and the ancient road which is above Panukome, but has been ploughed up by the peasants nearby so that they might appropriate the place. The road which now exists for Panukome was constructed later. Together with any hamlets which are found in the region, the peasants who live there with all their household and belongings, with the revenues of the 59th year at a price of 30 talents of silver, and also any of the peasants from this village who've moved to other places, on the condition that she pays no taxes to the royal treasury and that she will have the right to attach the land to any city that she wishes. In other words, the whole thing, lock, stock and barrel, was handed over to his divorced wife. And if you happen to be a peasant who, for one reason or another, had actually managed to move away 5 miles down the road to the next village, but you'd been born here, then you also were sold in that transaction as well. It's quite an astonishing document illustrating the absolute power of the rule of the Seleucids. The chief beneficiaries in this system, apart from the king himself, of course, were the king's friends, his so-called philoi. And throughout both the documents of Ptolemaic Egypt and in the documents from Seleucid Syria as well, we find reference to these men who, in a petition, will call themselves the philos, the friend of the king. This is a term which, as we know, had originated back in Macedon. We've already seen that the elite battalions of the Macedonian army were known as the companion cavalry or the companion infantry. But that idea, that sort of egalitarian ethos, that in a way we're really comrades with the king, men in arms with him, had now been extended. And in the Hellenistic world, the term philos really comes to mean a member of the imperial bureaucracy. If you're in the civil service, one of these Greeks or Macedonians, very rarely are local, but if you're one of these Greeks or Macedonians who benefit from this exploitative system, you are known as the king's philos. And these men were the military commanders of garrisons. They were the provincial commanders and regional governors. They were the officers in the villages, sometimes even down to the level of policemen or of scribes, who served as the administration for the entire empire. And they were reinforced, of course, by soldiers and by military contingents who were settled on the land holdings around the empire. So you had garrisons strategically placed, there would be soldiers on active service, and then around them there would be a Greek settlement that would grow up, and most of the men on that settlement would be veterans who could be called up once again if the need arose. So we've got a very clear occupation and exploitation of the territory going on. The only people who remained free of this very direct exploitation were the nomads in the mountains or the nomads in the deserts, the Bedouins, who remained free of active interference. And here, the Seleucids had learnt well from the Achaemenids that you could keep them on side as well. This is yet another way of dealing with a native population through the practice of gift exchange. Desert chiefs would be confirmed as independent potentates. They would recognize the power of some desert chief, provided that that chief would then send troops to the great musters of the Seleucid army. And that's why we read about camel corps serving with the Seleucid army, and why the cavalry from Armenia, which was famous, both served regularly in times of war with the Seleucid army. So the Seleucid army, the Seleucid realm, excuse me, presents an approach to kingship, to the problem of kingship and rule in the Hellenistic world. Because remember, we've been talking about how people from a small Greek kingdom of Macedon adapt to the requirements of ruling this vast empire. The Seleucid approach represents a style of kingship that I would call polyvalent. That is to say, the Seleucid kings play different roles, and they use different institutions depending upon which audience they're dealing with. There is no single coherent notion of Seleucid kingship. You can be a latter-day Alexander, as Antiochus III tried to be, or you can be a great Babylonian king who builds temples with his bare hands, as Antiochus I did. It depends upon who you're dealing with. The one innovation that I think the Seleucids do come up with is a system of shared kingship, and this is an intelligent adaption, whereby the senior man, the father usually, will hold western domains, and his son will be made a co-regent or a co-king, and will then be given the eastern realms of the empire, where he gets his training, if you will. And the size of the empire required such an arrangement. It means that you've got someone from the dynastic family in both the west and the east at any given time. And it's a system that works so well that the Ottomans replicate it later on. Ottoman princes are nearly always sent to the eastern side of the empire for their training before they rule at the Sublime Porte in Istanbul. So the Seleucid Empire can be thought of as a complex mixture. It was influenced by the prior history of Persian control in these regions. The Seleucids also practiced a sensible policy of non-interference where territorial control was out of the question in the Far East or in the deserts or in the mountains. And they practiced religious toleration in the well-established and ancient areas of Babylon and Mesopotamia. As was the case in all the realms then of the Hellenistic world, the institutions of the Seleucid Empire were really designed not so much to create harmony and fuse races, but rather to establish good order, to make it easier for a vast geographic area to be ruled by what in our terms would be a minuscule bureaucracy, but a bureaucracy which in the Hellenistic period was exclusively Greco-Macedonian.